Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to episode 12 of season 5. Can you believe it? Season 5 of the Wild Wild podcast. And we are bringing things almost to a close here. Our voyage into the apocalyptic wastelands is almost at an end. The uranium slash water slash whatever it is we're looking for is almost within our grasp. So joining me, as he has been throughout this epic journey, is my co-host and your friend, Rod Barnett.
Hello, everyone. I myself am slathered in uranium dust, petroleum of some type. I'm hoping it's jelly. And I'm trying to drench myself in water just so that I'm reminded of all the things that we've sought in the wasteland throughout this season.
Man. Yeah, we're still looking. We're still looking. So it's appropriate that today's film does have the word final.
Yes, indeed.
before we get into the film, Rod, have you got anything that you would like to tell our listeners about that you've been doing over on your many other channels?
The Bloody Pit is going strong. Got episodes coming. Got further episodes covering the Star Trek feature films, at least the original six. Those are continuing to come out as we go. I've got another episode featuring Universal horror movies from the 40s. Actually, a twofer of the first couple of Inner Sanctum movies. Those are always well worth talking about. We've doubled up because the films are so short. We'll have a Lucio Fulci episode coming up here in a few weeks. It's not going to be the next episode that drops, but we're doing an episode on Conquest.
You finally given in and you're doing a Franco and Ciccio movie.
that's exactly it. If Franco and Ciccio did wield fuzzy nunchucks, so yes.
Oh, I see. What did you say? Conquest.
Yes, Conquest.
Excellent. All right. I mean, I have wondered at times, you know, all the ideas that we've had for seasons, that there's definitely enough films to do an Italian caveman season, but I'm not sure I could handle 10 films of people going ugh and acting like Conan and, you know, that whole sort of caveman slash Conan the Barbarian thing. I mean, we could probably do it.
It's definitely doable. There's more than a few of those films out there, yeah.
But I'm not sure, yeah. If we get desperate. But anyway, no. That's cool. So we've got those to look forward to. And yeah, I had a little adventure this past week that I wanted to mention. And I think for the first time I can actually say that I went viral on social media. To a small scale. I mean, not to an Elon Musk scale. But on Thursday, I visited there's a long backstory to this that I won't bore you all with now. But basically, I was able to go and visit a cinema up in the West Midlands that has a huge collection of 35mm film cans just quietly rusting in its basement. So normally, cinemas would send the prints back after they were finished with them. But somehow, in the 70s, the manager of the cinema there managed to keep a whole load of them. And I think he may have been a distributor on the side, possibly. But anyway, so for 40-odd years, there's just been this huge collection of film cans down in the basement of this fabulous cinema. So they don't know what to do with them. No one's ever really properly looked through them all to even see what's on them, what's in them, I should say. So that ended up being me. So on Thursday with my son, we went down into this basement and I spent 2 hours getting covered in brick dust and film can rust, writing down what was on every single, what was in every single can. And what was really cool, and the reason I'm mentioning this now, is that half of it was British sex films, but the other half was Italian films. It was so cool. So they had all of the reels for films like The Last Hunter, Tiger Joe, The Beyond. They got The Beyond on 35mm.
Wow.
I know. City of the Living Dead was down there. So cool. I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I think there was a spaghetti western, at least one or two of those. Some of them may have had reels missing, but I need to go through my list and actually type it up so I can remind myself what there was. But I was just picturing, I was talking to them and I looked at some of the cans. Some of them I didn't want to open for fear of creating some kind of atmospheric change and they would crumble to dust in front of my eyes. But it looks like a lot of them are still projectable, like they're in good nick. So I was telling them they should organise some sort of 35mm exploitation film festival. It would be amazing.
Certainly.
So that was really, really cool. And so I just tweeted a photo of me with all these cans. And it went, I had to turn, this is the first time this has ever happened, I had to turn my Twitter notifications off that day because my phone was just buzzing constantly, constantly, constantly all day for about 2 days. It was amazing. People love film. And it was a really interesting reminder of that. Like, even though most cinemas only really went digital in the last 10 to 15 years, so most of us have got a memory of film.
Yeah.
But it's already basically just a memory, right? It hardly anywhere still projects a film. Like, they still had at the cinema on the massive big reels that would have been the ones that went into the projector, onto the projector. They still had all spooled up the last film that they ever projected on film there, which was Cowboys versus Aliens. So, you know, that's how recent films were still being projected on, primarily on film.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, it was really cool. So I got just hundreds of likes and retweets, and I think I've got over 200 new Twitter followers in the last 2 or 3 days. just because people are like, oh, I had lots of questions, you know, is any lost Doctor Who in there? That kind of stuff.
Right, well, yeah.
But, you know, but the answer is no, because it's all stuff that was being shown at the cinema.
Yeah, I was about to say that not likely. That kind of stuff, yeah. turns up in foreign television.
Yeah, exactly.
Television studio vaults, not anywhere else.
Yeah. So. Not in cinemas. But yeah, so anyway, a reason I mentioned it is because how cool it was that a lot of Italian stuff was in there. And so I am hoping to be instrumental in some way in getting some kind of Italian film day where they show like 3 of these things back to back. I think it would be amazing. So if that ever happens, I'll be sure to let you all know. But yeah, so that was my fun week. But enough of all that. It's time for us to get down to business here.
It sounds a lot like you're saying, well, enough with fun. Now let's
enough with fun. We've got to do it. Like, we've had our pudding. Now we have to eat our vegetables. And so we are, of course, today talking about L'Ultimo Guerriero, which I think means The Final Warrior. But the English translation is, of course, The Final Executioner.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at this point, I would play in some funky 80s synth theme track, but the opening credit music for this film is so depressing. It's very different from what we're used to from the last 9 films. So yeah, here's a clip. Yeah. Here's a clip anyway. Thank you. But do not worry, because later on in the film, there is some classic 80s post-apocalypse synth, which they do bring in every time there's a fight scene. So I'll pop a bit of that in later once we start talking about the plot. But yeah, the final executioner, Rod, was this... I mean, I feel like we're sort of scraping the bottom of the 1984 post-apocalypse barrel with this one. But is this a film you'd seen before?
No, this is one that had completely escaped my attention until the year of our Lord 2023. And I've got to say, I can see why. Don't get me wrong, I'm not going to pretend that it's the worst example, but it is rather kind of colorless. It doesn't really have anything that stands out.
Yeah.
That to kind of make it distinctive in any real way, it is a pretty effective time waster if you're willing to enjoy this type of cinema. But mm-hmm. it doesn't bring anything new to the table. It doesn't bring anything really overly interesting outside of just kind of enjoying the funky badness of the dialogue, or the funky badness of the costumes, or the funky badness of what they're trying to do.
It's got a very odd tone. It's very different in tone from our previous films,
mm-hmm.
which have mainly, you know, despite the fact that we're in a post-apocalyptic nightmare wasteland for most of the films, they're still quite fun. And there is zero fun in this film. No fun at all. So Romolo Guerrieri, I pronounced that wrong, I'm sure, which, if I'm right, like, this film is L'Ultimo Guerriero, the final warrior, the last warrior. So Romolo Guerrieri, I think his surname means warriors, because this film is L'Ultimo Guerriero, which is like warrior or fighter or whatever.
Okay.
So he's got the right name for an action film director. You know, it's like if your name was Robert Tough Guy or something. And I guess looking at his films, that is primarily what we would associate him with. You know, he started out in as a second unit on the sort of things you would expect in the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah.
But then very quickly sort of made his name in spaghetti westerns. So which of his films are you fond of? Because it's obviously not this one.
Well, I can tolerate this one, but yeah, I mean, the films of his that I'm aware of are Young, Violent, and Dangerous. I'd heard of Covert Action, which was made roughly, you know, the same period of time, mm-hmm. but that and The Sweet Body of Deborah from 1968 is a film that I'm aware of, and I hate to say this, I think I've seen it, but I can't remember. I think that's one that lurks back in the days of bootlegs. Mm-hmm. But I did take note of the fact that I'm aware of Johnny Yuma, and I know I saw it long ago and thought it was pretty good, but mm-hmm. that's kind of out of my head now as far as details. Too many westerns, too similar to each other. But also, it would be interesting to note that I do believe that his spaghetti western $10,000 Blood Money just came out on Blu-ray.
Oh, is it in that new Arrow box set of spaghetti westerns?
I do believe so. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I haven't got that yet. Yeah. So of course we talked about him last season with Young, Violent, and Dangerous, because that turned out to be a bit of a dark horse and it was really good. And
yep.
Not one of the better known Poliziotteschi films, and it was Thomas Milian without a mustache and almost unrecognizable at
which
first,
is always frightening.
Was,
yes,
like he was, or did he have a mustache? It was either, no, wait a minute. Oh no, he had a mustache. That was it.
Wait, did he
had
have
a mustache?
He had
a mustache, but he was the
commissioner. He was the commissioner in that one.
He had the suit on, and he'd combed his hair so that it was straight, and he looked very different from the other films that we're used to.
He looked
seeing
almost
him.
Like a normal human in that one. Yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't. It took me a while before I realized it was actually him. So that was a really good film, and I remember also at the time we talked a little bit about some of his other films then, and there's one that particularly intrigued me called La Guerrilla.
Oh God!
I don't know if you remember this one.
Of course, it intrigues you. It's a comedy.
It's a comedy, and the summary is great. I'm going to read it again. Ruby has been trained in martial arts by her father, and now has a job safeguarding a wide range of people and their valuables. A clumsy artist named Adelmo falls for Ruby at first sight but remains clueless about her profession. Things are complicated by Adelmo's French neighbour and sometime model having a crush on him, and Ruby's father trying to hook up his daughter with various bodybuilders while putting the moves on the French girl. I mean, that just sounds first class.
Okay, if that's your term, sure.
But according to the IMDb, at least, I think Romolo Guerrieri might still be alive.
Yes, I'm not aware of his having passed, and as a matter of fact, I think that, I do think that he has kind of retired away from films.
Yeah.
I mean, he was constantly doing assistant director's jobs and second unit director jobs all the way up through the beginning of the 90s. But I don't see any other credits for him.
The final Executioner was his last actual feature film.
Oh no, was it?
After that he just worked in TV films.
Oh, you're right, he did. Wow. But like I say, I think he went back to the whole assistant director and second unit director that's how he got into the business in the first place, it seems.
What a film to go out on, right? Like,
well, no, but at the same time, yes.
Yeah,
I'll just put it that way.
So, I guess let's do what we normally do. Let's just talk very briefly about the cast as well, because primarily people I was unfamiliar with the possible exception of Woody Strode,
mm-hmm.
who, like is often the case in these films, is sort of the token name that you've heard of chucked into the movie. He's somebody who I'm assuming you've seen in 100 things.
Oh, well, yeah, of course. I mean, you know, if you've ever seen Spartacus, you've seen him.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, he got his start. Remember Woody Strode was an athlete who became an actor. He was a football star at UCLA and he got involved in becoming part of the John Ford family of actors he would use repeatedly in different movies.
Yeah.
And then that kind of put him on screen in a way that allowed other people to be interested in casting him in different things. And so mm-hmm. he was in Spartacus, and he's very famously in that opening sequence of Once Upon a Time in the West, and just so many films over the years. I mean,
yeah. And so, he was even in the Batman TV series.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, loads of classics, Shalako, Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. You know, mm-hmm. he had a pretty decent career.
Yeah, and then he spent a few years making pretty decent money, I'm assuming, appearing in Italian exploitation films in the 80s and 90s, mm-hmm. While also, strangely enough, showing up in things like The Cotton Club and Storyville and Posse.
Yeah.
And with his last role being in 1995's The Quick and the Dead, which is a film I have a lot of time for. I think I really enjoy
it. Also a Western.
Yeah, love that movie. Love that movie quite a bit.
Oh, and he's in Lust in the Dust.
Yes.
Paul Bartel film with Divine. That film is great. So funny. So, yeah. So, obviously, he was just working around Europe at the time, and they spent probably most of their budget getting him into this one.
I see. Now, here's the weird thing. Are you sure about that? Considering that apparently the footage of Woody Strode in this movie later turns up in the Bronx it turns up in a different movie.
Yes, it's used. It was reused. So it was shot for this one.
Yeah.
But then it was reused in The Bronx Executioner and a film called Urban Warriors, neither of which I've seen. But yeah, apparently a bunch of scenes got recycled. But this was the film. This is the film he's supposed to be in. I guess.
This is the one they actually paid him for. We're sure of that. Okay.
They used it again when he wasn't looking and probably didn't pay him residuals.
Yes, exactly.
So, yeah, we'll talk about his character in a minute. But primarily, everyone else in this film, I'm completely unfamiliar with. Did you recognize any of the rest of the cast?
No, not really. There was one face that seemed familiar, but it turned out he just looks a whole lot like somebody else. That would be Harrison Muller,
who I want to talk about him a little bit.
Yeah, I didn't know. Like I said, one look at his face and I thought, man, I think I've seen that guy before. And I have. I mean, he was in 2020 Texas Gladiators, which is probably what I'm guessing made the little bell go off in my head. Yeah. But that's really it. I mean, I haven't seen Throne of Fire that he made the year before this film recently enough to remember specifically anything about him. And it's been a long time since I watched the Sandahl Bergman post-apocalyptic version of She. It's been a long time.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've ever seen that one, but I kind of feel like I should.
Yeah, you know, it would have fit in perfectly with this series of films, but at the same time, you would have needed a shower afterwards. It's not a particularly good movie.
And I think because there's a Harrison Muller Jr. and a Harrison Muller Sr., so I'm going to assume they're related.
Yeah.
So
Harrison, the senior was his father. Yes.
Yeah. So I'm going to assume that this is Harrison Muller Jr. And by a complete coincidence, this week to prepare for our next episode, I watched a film with Harrison Muller Sr. So they were both sort of still working around the same time.
Oh, really? Well, I mean, you know, a movie that we will end up talking about before we close this season out has Mr. Junior in it as well, although it's an even more poorly regarded film than this. So,
oh no, that is Harrison Muller Sr. According to IMDb, he's Warrior of the Lost World.
Oh no, it's definitely Junior because you can spot him if you watch these films back to back like the little psycho that I am. So
maybe they're both in it.
Oh my God, would that be possible? That would be terrifying. Father and son together in one of the worst films I've ever seen.
Yeah. Well, maybe then. Anyway, we'll get to that in the next episode. But yeah, he's kind of like the main... To begin with, the film sets it up as though he's going to be the main character.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like he's some kind of anti-hero. But then he turns out to just be he's actually the main villain. Even though he's the center of the poster and he looks the coolest. And it takes us a while to figure out who the hero is going to be, because we also meet at the beginning of the film a couple getting onto a tube train.
Yep.
Basically. And this is a guy whose character name I think is Alan, and he's played by William Mang, who is a German actor, I believe. He's primarily, well, based on his career, he's mainly been in German stuff.
I think he's actually born in Austria, but Austrian. It's close enough that it doesn't matter. Yeah.
Yeah. But the film, I don't think, was a German co-production. But anyway, he's in it. And a whole load of other people. There's a character called Edra, who's another sort of evil femme fatale, who only ever did two films. And the other one she did was Jungle Raiders.
I know, the Antonio Margheriti film. One of the Antonio Margheriti films from the 80s that I still haven't seen.
Oh, yeah, I haven't caught that one either. So she didn't do very much. And... Yeah, there's a few other people. It's such an odd film.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, there is one. Wait, there's one who I definitely recognized.
Oh, because
she's in The Adventures of Hercules.
Oh, this is true.
Margie Newton, mm-hmm. that she's credited as. Although I've got the suspicion that's not her real name.
I think it's Marina Costa.
Yeah.
Or no, that's not her name. That's the lady who was only in the two movies. I'm sorry. Margie Newton, you're correct.
Yeah, she was Aphrodite in the Hercules film.
She was also very famously in Hell of the Living Dead from Bruno Mattei.
There you go.
Yes, yes. So, you know, memorable in many ways. None of them particularly... Yeah.
And we also have another guy in here who plays a young... I think he's supposed to be maybe her little brother, the evil femme fatale. There's a kind of young guy that she's looking out for called Evan.
Mm-hmm.
And that actor is Carl Zinni, who is also in Demons, which I think quite a few times we've had people who turn out to also be in Demons.
Yeah, I think that both the Demons films have a pretty large cast to begin with.
I mean,
they got to kill a lot of people in those movies.
So there's a lot of people used up. So that's about it, really. And then there's just a whole bunch of other people who do have names mentioned, but like we don't really keep track of who they are and don't really care.
Well, they're essentially there to fulfill stereotypical roles in films of this type, and that's their purpose, and they serve it just well enough to get this thing by. So
So this film was also known as Rocket, Final Executioner. And the poster for some versions of the film has this really cool motorbike on it. And the VHS cover has a really cool motorbike on the front, which I think was, I think that was Erasmus, wasn't it? Erasmus had the cool motorbike.
Yeah.
Which is why at first we think he's going to be the hero, because he's got the cool bike.
Well, he's got the cool facial hair. He's got the cool motorcycle. He's a he's a badass with weapons. He's this. He seems to be the final executioner of the title, because
he's got a beard. He's got a kind of blow dry sort of wave going on there with his hair.
Yes, he does.
The way that he's dressed, I don't know if you've ever seen Blackadder, but he just reminded me so much of Blackadder.
It reminded me also just a little bit of how in later seasons of Blake's Seven they would dress Aven, all in black and silver.
Yeah. So here we go for a bit of a plot summary, and then we'll get into it. So okay, here's the description from the book After the World Ends.
Oh, okay.
In a future that we hope is not too imminent, a nuclear blast shook the Earth, transforming our green meadows into a desert wasteland. So this is a film that also starts with footage of mushroom clouds, mm-hmm. as we saw. Was that last time? Was that in the last film? A Man Called Rage, I think it was.
Yes. That was the depressing way in which A Man Called Rage began as well. Yeah.
Well, we thought that film had a depressing opening. My goodness, this film is grim. What this film reminded me of, the tone for the first kind of 20 minutes. Did you ever see that film? Oh, what's it called now? It's a 70s sci-fi movie about a group of survivors of a nuclear war who are in bunkers underground. And then it turns out that the bunkers have got giant bats.
Oh, you're talking about The Chosen Survivors.
Mm-hmm. I remember watching that, and it had like such a cool setup, but then just the tone of it was sort of relentlessly depressing. That's what this sort of reminded me of.
Yeah, and here's the thing. If you think about it, all the pieces are in place in what they're doing with this film to kind of... It's essentially a kind of blown-up, most dangerous game kind of situation in the post-apocalypse, right?
Yeah.
Where, you know, if you step out of line in the surviving society that seems to be mostly, you know, protected underground, they ship you up, you know, they ship you up top to be a victim chased around by various hunters for whatever reason. And seems like this could be a very interesting story that, you know, leads to the standard kind of revolutionary idea of the people being taken advantage of and being shoved out of society for dubious reasons, coming back to take the society in a better direction. But of course, that's not what this movie is interested in at all.
No. as you've touched on there, I'll just read the next little bit because it sort of explains the world that we're in. Under the scorching sun of the future, class warfare didn't disappear at all. A group of privileged people still enjoy the comfort of civilization and modernity, while the damned of the earth are kept in contaminated areas where not only do they have to face the radioactive reaper, but they also serve as game for hunters. The latter like to come every so often to the Forbidden Land to glut their sadistic tendencies, but they eventually end up chasing the wrong rabbit. I do love the way this book phrases stuff.
Well, I have to say, every time I read a section out of this book, there's a big part of me that just really wishes someone that was a native English speaker had taken a swipe, just one swipe.
Yeah,
rewriting this translation from the French. Yeah.
Yeah. Just have a bit of a pass at it. So like you said, if you step out of line, there are a couple. So the beginning of the film, after the nuclear explosions, we see Alan Tanner and what we assume is his wife. Although I don't think we ever hear her name.
I don't even think do we even really ever know? Did they know each other before this?
I don't know. They seem to, because they're together and she seems very upset. And they are being kicked out. They've been sentenced to go out into the wastelands to be hunted, where they stop being referred to as people. And they're basically just fair game, like you said. And they get sent out, or they get put on an underground train. They're in separate carriages, and they're let out at different stops. And then they are the hunted. And then we don't see them again for a while, and our attention shifts to Erasmus, our blow-dried anti-hero, which we think is a first. And he's out just riding his motorbike, and the wastelands appear to be policed. There's kind of, yeah, they're basically cops chasing him, weren't they? I think.
Yeah, they seem to have been the culled. You know, these are people who are part of kind of an elite group of hunters who go out and kill these people. And there's almost a throwaway line in the movie where they talk about how they've done this so long to so many people. There's like they've killed like 80 million people, and it's and it's one of those moments where you're like, wow, that's a lot. And if the idea was to present them as part of the upper crust, the wealthy part of society who are just, you know, given free rein to murder the lower castes and the outlaws, you know, just the people that society deems unworthy, the movie sets it up and then just ignores it. I mean, the only visuals, the only thing that we really get for the rest of the film is just the fact that these hunters, when not actively attempting to shoot people, are lounging around this gorgeous Italian villa, and that's it. I mean, that's what we get as far as the level of decadence of these characters.
And they seem to be. It's all very well organized. Like they have licenses, and there are zoned areas where they can go and hunt. But Erasmus has got basically an all access backstage pass. He can go wherever he wants because he's a cool dude with a big gun and a fancy motorbike, and he knows Edra, who seems to be in charge, I guess.
Well, in charge of this sector, and apparently other sectors as well. Apparently there's some kind of bidding that goes on where you get control of certain sectors. And I still don't understand how you would make money off of this, though. How do you make money off of this at all? Are you selling? Are the licenses expensive, maybe?
Possibly, because it's supposed to be the wealthy, isn't it? The wealthy and decadent of society.
Yeah,
and
I guess.
The idea is that they're picking off the contaminated, irradiated people who are out there in the wastelands. But the reason we find out, so Alan Tanner, we find out later, the reason he was kicked out is he's some kind of electrical engineer, scientist guy who discovered that the wastelands are no longer irradiated, like it's no longer dangerous out there, so they should probably stop killing everybody, and the government didn't like that, so they kicked him out there as well. And I don't know how to describe the plot.
Well, see, but you've just spoken about the thing that the center, what should have been the centerpiece of this film, which is the underlying truth of the society. But it's just, it's nothing ever comes from it. Nothing, it's just his justification for being really, really pissed about being put in the place that he is, because he discovered the truth, and the you know, the leaders, the rulers don't want the truth to be known. It's like, you could have done, they could have done something really interesting with that.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're known as expendables. These people who are out there, and then you've got the hunt. So it's this game, and it's quite high tech. So Edra, back in this villa, has got all this equipment to monitor what's going on. They've also got CCTV cameras in their own villa, but they're also monitoring. They've got radio contact with people out there in the wilds and so on, and they're competing with each other. It's become such a game that they just sort of compete with each other about who can kill the most people. So Erasmus and Edra have a bit of a competition going, and because Edra wants to win Erasmus's fancy heat-seeking rifle. And then, because he's basically got a rifle and a sword, he seems to be the gentleman murderer.
the gentleman, I like that.
Yeah. So, basically we stick with them for a while they find a big group in a quarry. Because, of course, we're in a quarry.
Of course.
And they gun them all down. They just gun loads of people down in this quarry, all the regular expendables. But a couple manage to escape. And then one of them turns out to be Alan's wife, Alan Tanner's wife, who I've forgotten her name already because I don't think we ever got it. But anyway, Alan's wife, they catch her and they decide that instead of killing her, because she's not been out in the wastelands very long, even though technically she's not a human anymore, they can still rape her anyway. So not Erasmus, but one of the other guys in this gang,
decides
that he's going to rape her. But there's also this guy, Evan. I don't know whether he's supposed to be Edra's little brother, but she's kind of looking after him. He's like 16 or something. He's like, oh, can I have a go as well?
And can so she's I have like, some yeah, fun, sure. mummy?
Whatever, yeah, sure. Whilst Edra and... So then whilst that's happening... Oh, that's right, because Alan is there. So they beat Alan up, rape his wife, mm-hmm. drag Alan off, tied to a rope on the back of a truck, and then dump him, with the idea being that they're then going to go and hunt him. And he manages to run away. They chase him. Edra shoots him and he falls into a lake or a river or something. And we think he's dead. But then he wakes up in a bed inside an old abandoned factory, because, of course, that's where we are.
Where else are we going to shoot this thing?
We've got quarries and abandoned factories. And he is being nursed back to health by none other than Woody Strode.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you describe this character of Sam?
Deus Ex Machina? No, that's not true.
He's not yet.
That happens at the end of the movie.
Yeah, although he has saved... I mean, he's basically saved Alan from drowning or dying or something.
Essentially, the Woody Strode character of Sam is the... he's the older mentor, the retired, grizzled man who turns out at the end was an ex-cop, and he spends... he nurses this fellow back to health for whatever reason, and then spends several montages training him to be a fighter, someone who can actually hold his own against these scumbag rich people with guns, and then sends him
off. It's very sadistic training.
Oh yeah, of course.
It's like, crawl through this tunnel full of barbed wire, stand here while I punch you repeatedly in the face.
I kept waiting for him to force him to eat a frog or something. It's like, what's next, man? What are you doing?
Is this really training, Sam, or are you just getting some kind of kick from this here? This seems a bit much.
Is this just the way that you kind of laugh yourself to sleep at night? How do you do this?
Yeah, though it's a very strange tone to this whole thing.
Yeah, but I mean, it is perfect in that if there weren't enough identifiers of the decade in which this film was made, the training montage is actually that puts it all to rest. It's like,
it does just need the Rocky theme over it, and it really does.
It would be just as appropriate for what's going on here, crawling under barbed wire, and you know, all the different ridiculous stuff.
Yeah, running. He's got to run and dive, duck between all these swinging bags of sand or something. And
yep.
Yeah, it's very, very Rocky. But then after the training appears to be finished, Sam pulls out a gun. And it turns out he's got a Magnum. And Alan is like, oh, why didn't you say that in the first place?
It's like, wait a minute, you've got a gun?
But it turns out he's only got one bullet.
Like Barney Fife. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Straight from Mayberry to the wasteland.
Sam is training him up so that he can go and take this ultimate revenge. But Sam's got some kind of... I don't know exactly. I don't know whether he's just been waiting around for years for the right guy to come along that he can train up and stuff on his behalf.
Maybe our main character, Alan, here is like the third or 20th person he's fished out of a lake, and they've turned out to be crap. They've gotten an infection and died or something. He's like, I'll keep trying.
If Sam wants to fight back against the elite, why hasn't he already done it? Why has he been hanging around training up white guys?
People who aren't already trained. What are you doing?
So that happens, and then Alan is set free to go, and this is basically the last third of the film is a kind of siege movie where Alan is going to get his own back on Edra and Erasmus and all the people in this villa. Now, if he's also trying to look for his wife, we just never hear anything about her again. Did they kill her? I don't know if you noticed. I noticed a few times the editing was a bit wonky, and I felt like there was stuff they maybe just didn't shoot.
Well, that and not you're right. I completely agree. And there are more than a few moments in the film where I kept wondering why are, how is this happening? But also the continuity in the film is wonky as well. Mm-hmm. There are moments when things happen and it seems as if we're seeing a scene that should be taking place after another scene. Mm-hmm. And not just that, just the physical continuity of for instance, our main character, our hero, Alan, is still wearing the same clothing that he started the whole thing out in, but it magically no longer has a bullet hole or blood on it. and it's really, really strange. I mean, because like there's some place he could have gone to have gotten a completely different wardrobe that just looked amazingly same.
Now we know why Sam hasn't already gone on this revenge mission, because he's been too busy running his dry cleaners.
fair point. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, it does feel like there's stuff that even just sort of basic coverage. Like there's a scene where our main people are all looking at something.
Yeah.
But we don't get the reverse, so we don't know what they're looking at.
I know, and there's a couple of points like that in the movie where it's, are we going to get, I actually would say out loud, are we going to see what it is? Are you going to show us?
So it feels like a film that was clearly made, it probably had a really good script, but it was made under difficult conditions, and maybe they just ran out of money or
maybe
time pressure or something. Maybe Alan just took too long to learn how to crawl under that barbed wire.
Possibly.
And so they ran, every time he snagged his shirt, they had to rip another page out of the script.
Well, crap, now we can't even afford to film this.
Yeah.
Well, here's a question. You mentioned that it is possible from the outline of what we see presented on the screen, you can see vague hints at what the script may have been. And the reason I'm going to agree with you and say that who knows what was on the page might have been much better than what we ended up with on screen is because when I look at the credits for the guy who wrote this, I take note of the fact that while there's some stuff in his background that I'm not that doesn't look particularly, you know, impressive or anything like that, but he did write things like My Dear Killer and Casablanca Express. Not that that's any particular great film or anything of that nature, but he's also responsible for the adapted screenplay for Santa Sangre.
Right.
And he wrote the screenplay and story for American Rickshaw, which, you know, remember, you know, like I said, like it's not one of the greatest films in the world, but it is incredibly entertaining. And you start to think, wow, this guy had a script writing career that stretched well into, I mean, just a few years ago. I mean, there's a movie he he wrote that came out in 2021. This guy, So I start to think back to this and looking at all these different credits, and also knowing that with any screenwriter anywhere, there, you know, for every script that gets produced, there's probably 3 to 4 to 5 that he's written for different people that, you know, managed to never get produced for whatever stupid reason. And then ideas that he's written on spec. So who knows how many scripts he wrote over the years. But like I say, there are elements in the story of this film that point to the fact that this could have been, not to be cruel, but much better than this is.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, I mean, I think you may have deliberately missed out one of Roberto Leone's finest writing credits, which was for the 1973 comedy Il Gatto di Brooklyn Esperante Detective.
Oh, I missed that one, yeah.
Or, which I think means the aspiring detective is a cat in Brooklyn. I don't know. But anyway, but it's one of the films after Franco and Ciccio split up. It's one of the films that Franco made on his own.
Oh, you're kidding me. Really?
So yeah, that's a Franco film, but no Ciccio.
Oh my goodness. There's a certain part of me that worries that you get so focused on this. I mean, why not pay more attention to the script that he wrote for the film, which I still haven't seen. called The Master Touch with Kirk Douglas. Mm-hmm.
Well, this one has got Camille Keaton in it, you know, so there's some interest there. And Luigi Pistilli.
but I will say I do want to see The Master Touch one day. So not just because of Kirk Douglas, but because it also has Florinda Balkan and Giuliano Gemma, and just looks pretty interesting, I have to admit.
Yeah. So yeah, so I think, but you know, the script for this was probably pretty solid. But I definitely think that editing is involved with why this film doesn't quite hang together. There's definitely stuff missing.
It feels like a movie that didn't have enough time to get, you know, I think they had to make a lot of shortcuts to get the thing finished, essentially.
Because we never see Erasmus's motorbike again, I don't think.
Yeah, no, no.
He spends the rest of the film on foot.
I think they may have had the rental of those motorcycles for a day or two, and that was it.
So I looked this film up in Matt Blake's book as well, because he'd written about them, to see what he thought. And he said any promise that the film has is nulled by the fact that it displays all the symptoms of a typical late-entry Italian B-movie, a plot made of elements taken from previous productions, a lack of care over the dubbing and post-production, and a budget which barely covers the cost of the film negative, let alone shooting anything decent with it. I mean, just sort of harsh. I mean, he does use the word sluggish, which I think is sort of fair. It's a bit murky. It is kind of murky, but that might just be because it only ever got a VHS release. So that's on YouTube, and it is a bit murky. Maybe we would assess this film as slightly better if Severin brought it out on Blu-ray, for example.
Hey, and I would be more than willing to watch it again if there was a presentation made with some kind of information about, you know, the production that would give us an enhanced idea of just why it turned out the way it did. I'm a masochist like that. So
yeah, no, me too. I would be interested. I'm sure there's probably some good stories behind this film, but just not in front of the camera, sadly.
Apparently not, perhaps being
too harsh. There are definitely interesting things. It's much more adult in tone than some of the other films. I mean, we have seen boobs, I should say, in at least one of the Joe D'Amato films, but this is the first film that has a full-on sex scene and a kind of attempts at eroticism, whereas the other films not really, I would say. So it's trying to do something a bit more grown up, I guess you could say, or more. It's leaning in more heavily on exploitation. The violence is not that. There's not that much in the way of blood and guts, with the violence. I don't think. Have I remembered that wrong?
Maybe, which is another element that I think shows off the budgetary constraints that they were probably under.
It's cheaper to get people to take their clothes off than it is to create nasty wounds and stuff, but there are deaths, there's lots of shooting. I mean, they go through a lot of blanks.
A lot of blanks,
there's a lot of weaponry, so they did have some money, but yeah, it's an interesting one. So, you know, I'm not saying don't watch this film, I'm just saying go into it cautiously.
Well, I mean, it is easy enough to see if you're curious. I mean, it's sitting there on YouTube, it's easy enough to watch.
And there's good stuff in it, but it's just very interesting how different it is. And like I said, it's got this tone that's quite kind of gloomy, but then every time there's a fight scene, like I said, the synthesizers really kick in. So just to end on a bit of a high, here is some of that classic synth whilst people are punching each other. And there you go. So that was the score was provided by somebody who only scored two things, according to the IMDb. this film, and then another one 6 years later. So I guess they were probably doing other things. I would like to think they're maybe just too busy on tour. But that's your classic kind of 80s synth pop. But that music, because we've got so used to this depressing film, the music suddenly feels very out of place when it kicks in, which is really odd. But anyway, that is the final executioner. Rod, anything else to say before we wrap things up on the final executioner?
No, I don't think nothing of real concern, other than to just stress that, while, you know, you mentioned at the beginning of this that we probably with this film are scraping the bottom of the barrel. I would agree. At the same time, I enjoy this genre enough to have not had any real trouble getting through this film, simply because I love the compare and contrast game in my own head about the various films in this genre and from this period. You know, post-apocalyptic Italian films of this time, I love kind of seeing the variations, and that's kind of most of the joy that I got from this film. I did at the beginning think that since they were setting up this to be a variation on The Most Dangerous Game, that was going to play out in a more interesting way. And honestly, they kind of just sand all of that, all of the spiky, interesting pieces off of that as the film goes along. For whatever reason, who knows, we may never completely find out. But I will say this, if someone could manage to arrange interviews with people who made this film, the actors, just to get some insight into the production, if any of them, I mean, who knows how long were they doing this for 2 weeks? Will they remember anything about the production considering their life at the time? You know, I would love to get an idea of how the film came about and what the experience was like. Just out of curiosity, you know, are some of the things that you and I are surmising, are they true? You know, was there a more interesting story or script, you know, that people were staring at, but it just could not get onto the film? I'd be curious to know. But as far as this being the 10th film in this series that we cover, 10 out of 10, I understand. I'm glad we did this one, because it is yet another of the few that I'd never seen before. But now it's very easy to see why this one does not have a long list of champions that would have made this one something that I came to earlier than this now, as we're kind of plowing our way through more obscure elements of this genre. It's not one of the best.
No, but we'll. But hey, stay tuned for our next episode, everybody, and you'll find out where Rod and I think this film sits, and with all the other films, we're going to rank the 10 films that we've covered, and I bet you can't guess where this film is going to be placed.
Actually, I bet you probably can't when you
tenterhooks for the next at least the next 2 weeks to find out what we think. All right, before we go, we've had quite a lot of feedback in the last 2 weeks, which I wanted to just share with you before we finish. We had a message from Tom Peterson, who says, I just wanted to say I enjoyed the latest Wild Wild podcast that you did on A Man Called Rage. Big fun, as always. He then says, upon the recommendation of you two learned gentlemen, that's very nice, I will now enjoy the Italian-Spanish-German co-production, whose title roughly translates as Susan Scott's Ocelot Cries at Midnight Because Marina Malfatti Got Traces of Umberto Rajo's Deep Red on Horst Frank's Cold Grey Table Again. So there you go. That's one to add to our list of lost jellos.
I think the alternate title for that one is Deep Purple. Or possibly Deep Puce. I'm not sure.
Yes, absolutely. We had, speaking of it, so that was because we last Mark Eggins got in touch, and we talked about his idea last time about sort of giallo type things and the idea of doing a giallo adjacent season. So he's got in touch with again. He's mentioned Murder Mansion as a potential example of something like that.
Oh, I love that movie so much.
Yeah, which is really fun. He says the Rich Young People on Yacht series could be awesome. He likes a lot of the genre stuff for its satirical side, which Giallo has a lot of.
Mm-hmm.
He mentions Five Dolls for an August Moon and Nine Guests for a Crime. So, I mean, these are all good suggestions.
Yeah, definitely.
He also mentions how much, of course, he loves the 70s political thriller. which is an interest. Often they sort of straddle the art house and the Poliziotteschi.
True, true. I've not dipped into the Italian stream of that stuff for a very long time. In recent years, I've paid more attention to the Spanish end of that pool. But yeah.
Right. And as I think Radiance Films are starting to put out films that are a bit more along that sort of line. They just put out a Franco Nero sort of mafia box set where I think it's sort of political cops trying to take down the corruption and all that sort of thing. So I think there's more of that coming out again now. He also mentions a film which I've not heard of called Illustrious Corpses, which he says is not available on physical media at the moment. Have you ever heard of that one?
No. What's Illustrious Corpses?
Illustrious Corpses, yeah.
No, from what year?
I haven't looked it up. 70s Italian political thriller. So
does not ring a bell for me, no.
Okay, that's some homework for us to do. Thank you, Mark, for getting in touch. Also, another thing. I think since we last did the podcast, I went to a talk at a local cinema where they were putting on an hour's sort of mini lecture, really, about the Peplum film. And then they did a screening of Hercules, Samson, and was it Hercules, Samson, and Ulysses?
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah, I'm aware of that film. That's a good one, yeah. if memory
serves. So that was really fun. I went to that. It was really good to see that on the big screen. And I met a guy there. We got chatting, and it turns out that he was Italian. So his name is Luca. So hi, Luca, if you're listening, because obviously I heavily plugged the podcast in our conversation.
Good job.
So he was giving me some recommendations. So I just wanted to listen. He sent me a message recommending Fernando De Leo films.
Oh,
and
yes.
Also, I mentioned that I'd never seen a Bud Spencer and Terence Hill film. Oh, so,
well, that's interesting. I mean, even though those are generally comedic films, and I have a slight allergy to Italian comedies, I will admit to having had some amused laughter issue forth while watching a few of their films. I'll admit that very openly. Yes.
Yeah, he mentions a couple like They Call Me Trinity,
mm-hmm.
Watch Out, We're Mad. That sounds good. God Forgives, I Don't. So yeah, I need to check out some of those. He's been going back listening to old episodes, and hey, if you're a recent listener as well, do check out our archive of almost 50 episodes. So there's something in there for everybody.
Wow, really? Have we really made that many? Wow.
We will hit 50 in the next couple of months.
Whoa.
So he says he's listened to our podcast about Operazione Luna. And says, I totally agree on your Franco and Ciccio comparison with other comedians and in general about Italian comedies in the 70s. It's very difficult humor to understand outside Italy for many jokes are linked to specific events or people. So, yeah. And then, yeah. So anyway, thank you, Luca, for getting in touch, which he did. Both he and Mark contacted us through Instagram. So you can do that too if you haven't. Final bit of feedback is from Kurt, who's been in touch before. Thank you, Kurt. He says, Dear Apocalypsiteers. Apocalypsiteers.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you for your continued coverage of the most important stories of our time. You've helped me plan my investments more properly for the coming future. So far, I've invested heavily in Hairspray, desert and spiky car attachments.
Oh yeah.
And I haven't regretted it. Now to hoard all the water to discourage theft, I'll keep it right next to the uranium.
Yes.
I'm kidding, of course. The water is already full of microplastics. No one would steal that. And now he makes a good point. He says, I know you don't spoil the movies you cover, but would you be willing to do a survey of post-apocalyptic film endings as part of a season wrap-up? I'd like to get a sense of how much hope it's reasonable for humanity to have. I don't think you need to go into detail, but of the films you covered, what were the characters' prospects at the end? How many people were left? And how long could they hope for continual survival? I mean, that sounds like a tagline of a poster for one of these films. And what was the ending you'd most like to come true? For me, the ending of 2019 after the fall of New York is one of the goofiest things I've ever seen. I suspect it was inspired by the Planet of the Apes movies, but it was interesting enough that I kind of wish it would happen. I have to admit, I've already forgotten because I've seen so many of these back to back. What was the ending of After the Fall of New York?
Oh, don't you remember? We discovered we discovered that the woman has been impregnated by Big Ape.
Oh, yeah. Is that the one where they go to survive in an Arctic base somewhere after getting out of New York? They go off and live in the Arctic.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's pregnant with Big Ape. Yes, okay. Finally, thank you for starting this podcast and keeping it going. Adrian, you and Rod, he sent this to me, but he's talking to both of us. You and Rod play off each other terrifically. I look forward to your next commentary track. Oh, he says, I don't know for sure what it is, but if my guess is right, it will make a long-awaited Gothic even more stellar. Well, Kurt, I couldn't possibly say because, annoyingly, they still haven't announced it.
So they still have not announced it. Yes, this is true.
But I think we can say it's a Gothic. That's fine, right?
This is true. Yes, it is.
So, yeah, thank you, Kurt. So we are, if you listen to our next episode, which will come out in a couple of weeks, we are going to do a bit of a rundown of the 10 films. And so I'm sure some discussion may include the discussion will start that sentence again. I'm sure that it may include some discussion of what was happening towards the end of these films and who has survived. We'll try and get some of that in there. But anyway, that is it. Thank you, everybody, for listening, for sticking with us through this amazing journey across the wastelands and through the scrapyards of the apocalypse. We could talk a little bit about what's coming next season.
Should we do that?
Yeah. Set that up. So we've got one more episode in this season, which will be our ranking episode, and then we will launch into a mini season. And Rod, this was your idea. So do you want to explain a little bit about what our mini season is going to be?
Yeah, yes, this kind of was my idea, so I will take the arrow for this. The mini season is going to be another little short one, mainly because I think that if we wallowed in this subgenre for far too long, we would go mad. But we are going to view a few of the Italian Jungle Girl movies that were all the rage from roughly the beginning of time to the mid-70s, maybe early 80s. There are a few of them. There aren't as many as you might think. And the quality... actually, I don't know that the quality varies. There's kind of a mid-range of quality with they all kind of circle around. But that is what we're going to do. We're going to cover a few Italian Jungle Girl movies to kind of compare and contrast, to talk about that subgenre in detail a little bit, simply because I know I find it of interest. I can't imagine why. And Adrian has been kind enough to indulge me in this.
Yeah. So I've made a short list, but I haven't narrowed it down to the final three yet. And one of these films I can't find anywhere, so that probably comes off the list straight away.
Probably.
So actually, I think that leaves six. So I'll tell you the six that we've got, and then it would be great if anyone listening wants to recommend which ones they think we should cover. That might be good. But I've got Gungala e la Pantera Nuda. We've got another Gungala. There's another Gungala films, like Gungala La Vergina. We've got Samoa Regina della Giungla, or Samoa Queen of the Jungle.
Mm-hmm.
We jump into the 80s. There's another one from the 60s, Tarzana the Wild Girl.
did you include Luana, the 1968 film?
Luana? No, I haven't got that on here. I should add that.
Yeah, that one's... I've spent a lot of time with that movie, and that's probably the wrong way to have phrased that.
Okay, fine. So then we also so Luana. Okay, I'll add that to the list. Tarzana, the Wild Girl. Then into the 80s, we've got Daughter of the Jungle, and I thought it might be fun to throw in a late one, Amazonia, the Catherine Miles story.
Oh, that's an interesting film
combines the Jungle Girl with the cannibal film.
And purports to be based on a real story.
Back in the days when you could use somebody's real name in your exploitation film and not get sued somehow. So anyway, that's the sort of the long short list. And we need to narrow that down to 3 films in the next few weeks. So if anybody wants to make any recommendations as to which of those you think we should listen to, or alternatively, suggest some other ones. The main challenge for me with looking at these ones was, are they available for us to watch? Because surprise, surprise, not many of these films are available commercially.
I know, which, and don't get me wrong, I kind of knew that to a degree, but it was a bit of a shock to realize
it's
that.
It's a shame.
Yeah. It was a bit of a shock to realize that nobody, there's no little boutique Blu-ray company or even DVD company has really dived headlong into this particular shallow pool.
I know. I mean, it's, but that's kind of been the continuing story of this podcast.
I agree. I stumbled across this fact a long time ago and had forgotten it when we had to track down a couple of, at least a Jungle Girl movie that Paul Naschy was involved in the mid-70s, and realized, wow, the only way to find this is this incredibly terrible copy that you can find. Yeah. You know, it looks like garbage, but yeah.
So. Yeah. I know. If resources, access to resources were not an issue, I would be starting the Wild Wild Blu-ray label tomorrow.
That would be great.
And I'd be all over this stuff. But anyway, okay, so that's what's coming. But next episode will be our final episode of this season. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Get in touch in all the usual ways. The links are all in the show notes. And I've been Adrian. Rod has been Rod.
yes, I have been.
And we'll be back soon. Bye for now.
Bye, everyone.